From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are following today's horrific story out of Virginia. A TV reporter and cameraman shot and killed on air as their colleagues and viewers in Roanoke watched. Just a terrible story. The station now says the suspect in the shooting, a former station employee, has taken his own life.
Okay, and that story took over the airwaves today. We'll continue to follow it. Just horrific. But before that, the talk was of the Donald Trump, Jorge Ramos dust-up at a press conference in Dubuque, Iowa last night. Let's start there. Ramos, the popular Univision anchor, was unceremoniously removed from the presser when he kept asking questions without being called on. Here's Trump on the Today Show today.
He was totally out of line last night. I was asking and being asked a question from another reporter. I would have gotten to him very quickly. And he stood up and started ranting and raving like a madman.
But Jorge Ramos told ABC he had waited his turn, that two reporters before him asked their questions. He stood up to ask his. And then this happened. It played out live on cable news channels.
Okay, who's next? Yeah, please. Excuse me, sit down. You weren't called. Sit down. Sit down. Sit down. Go ahead.
I have the right to ask the question.
No, you don't. You haven't been called.
I have the right to ask the question.
Go back to Univision. Go ahead.
Well, in addition to that, there's the dust-up that's flared up again between Donald Trump and Fox News. So let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. And David, your reaction when you watched that exchange?
Oh, it just spoke to the contempt that Mr. Trump has for people who ask him questions that he doesn't want to field and doesn't treat him as a celebrity in a political realm as opposed to a politician running for the highest office of the land who has to take questions, sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes even in the case of Jorge Ramos, a bit hostile. This is him basically saying you don't have the right to ask the question. In his – you know, the way he handled Ramos, you know, you didn't see him saying I'll get to you next or I'm going to address this reporter's questions first. He said, no, you don't have the right. Sit down. I didn't call for you. Go back to Univision. That's a pretty contemptuous way of approaching a working journalist.
Well, there's background to it, too, because after Ramos was unceremoniously brought out by some of Donald Trump's people, Trump did speak to some of the press there. Some of the press did speak up and say, well, wait a second, shouldn't you be speaking with him? And he said, I don't even know who he is. And then later, when Jorge Ramos came back in the room, he said, I'm suing you, right? I'm suing you and Univision. So he knows who he is. What else is going on here?
Well, he knows exactly who he is. Univision, in the wake of remarks by Trump on illegal immigration, his desire to send back to Mexico, to other parts of Latin America, people who are here without legal status, caused Univision to sever ties over the Miss Universe pageant, which it broadcast to its Spanish-speaking audiences, you know, major, huge part of the American viewing audience. Jorge Ramos is the lead anchor for that network. He is one of the best-known anchors in this country of all anchors, very popular, very powerful, very argumentative when it comes to this issue. He has been somewhat you could say radicalized. He's certainly been activated, and he does a kind of advocacy journalism, holding Democrats and Republicans responsible for promises they've made to create a path to legal immigration status for people who are in this country without legal status, but also to sort of fight back or certainly argue against those who oppose the kinds of path that he would advocate. So Ramos has a different stance than what you might think of from an Associated Press reporter or what a CNN anchor might sound like. But he is taking the kind of world of cable and internet advocacy journalism to a more prominent level because he is such a well-known anchor for his audience.
Well, he responded today to accusations that he's more advocate than journalists. He said you have to take a stand. Some were suggesting this morning, some analysts, that maybe the press corps should have walked out with him. But I just want to ask you in the time we have about the new dust-up with Fox News that had died down and then Donald Trump retweeted again disparaging remarks about anchor Megyn Kelly. And Fox News CEO Roger Ailes wrote a letter out saying, please stop. All the anchors on Fox News did the same. You know, there's some who are saying that Donald Trump was created in part by Fox News. Now maybe he's turning on them.
There's been a mutually reinforcing relationship between Donald Trump and the media, and particularly Donald Trump and Fox News, which has treated him as a figure to be taken seriously. And he has gone after Megyn Kelly and some others, but Megyn Kelly in particular, so hard that Ailes felt compelled, as though his own judgment in making Kelly, the franchise player of the future for Fox News, had been in question. And so Ailes felt, you know, he needed to condemn Trump hard, and that you saw what was a coordinated series of condemnations from Fox people who had been silent to that point, more or less, about Trump's attacks. And I think that, you know, on the one hand, that Ailes is used to deference from Republican figures, conservatives. And on the other hand, it serves both of them in a sense. You have rising poll numbers for Trump. You have rising ratings for Fox News and all the other channels that put him on when they talk about Trump. So it's a there's a little bit of a wrestling federation approach to this as well.
Interesting to see how this one plays out with Fox News. NPR's media correspondent David Falkenflik, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, one of the world's most respected physicists, Stephen Hawking, has a new theory about black holes he's just unveiled at a conference in Sweden. Priya Natarajan joins us to explain. She's a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the very basics. What is a black hole?
So a black hole is an end state of a star. So it is once a star exhausts its entire fuel supply, it ends up and forms this very dense, compact object. And what is enigmatic about the black hole is the fact that the black hole is a physical entity. It's an astrophysical entity. We have one at the center of our galaxy and so on. But it also poses an important problem for physics because it encloses a singularity, a point where all laws of physics break down. But it has this hard boundary, this boundary called the event horizon, its armor, which encloses that singularity. So it's kind of an intriguing beast because it pushes our notions of both understanding of classical physics as well as quantum mechanics. And so they're very enigmatic. They're real objects, but they also are these sort of mathematical entities that are very, very intriguing.
And Stephen Hawking now says what about them?
So one of the big paradoxes about black holes is that they retain no memory of how they formed. So you can't actually figure out what was the mass of the star that exploded that gave you this little black hole. And you can't also, there's no memory of what it fed most recently. So all information is lost once it crosses the event horizon. So what Professor Hawking is saying now is that, and this has been a problem because we know that, you know, information can't completely disappear. So where is it stored or is it just not retrievable? And so now he has this interesting proposal that the information is actually not lost. It is somehow retained in this event horizon, in this sort of casing around the singularity.
And you're making a motion with your hands when you describe that, and people can't see that. But if we think of a black hole as kind of a vacuum, once it has become a black hole, you're talking about the rim of the vacuum.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you're saying that there, or he's saying that there might be some information that gets stored in that rim of what has gone into the black
Absolutely.
Hole.
Absolutely. And the question is, can we ever recover that information, right? And actually, he has a very nice analogy. He says, it's like the ashes of Encyclopedia Britannica. So the ashes actually contain all the information if we have the entire heap. But can we actually retrieve the encyclopedia from the ashes? No.
Well, and the other thing that sci-fi geeks would be asking is, well, couldn't you just go into the black hole, out into the potential other universe on the other side, if such a thing exists, and see what went in there?
Well, that's the realm of speculation and science fiction. I'll leave it at that. So wormholes aren't quite real.
We don't know about that yet. Okay. Well, the interesting thing here also is that Stephen Hawking said last year, there are no black holes.
Right. So I think this the structure of the event horizon, what it really is, has been a real sort of showstopper for many of us who've been thinking about black holes. So last year, there was a discussion about whether you have a firewall or fuzz. And people had come up with this idea that, you know, because the singularity is so problematic and information is so problematic, maybe what you really have is something called a fuzzball, where there is no singularity and there's no event horizon. So the notion of a black hole is disrupted. And so that's what Hawking was saying last year, as were many other physicists from Santa Barbara. They've all been thinking about this. And it's just, you know, this idea of the singularity is something that's very problematic to us because it's a place where all known laws break down. So if there's sort of a way around it, people have been trying to look for a long time. In fact, this idea of the singularity prevented acceptance of the idea of a black hole for a very long time. So that was what he said last year. And now what he has shown is that you can recover the usual notion of a black hole as a singularity in space-time enclosed with an event horizon, because he's now figured out that the information isn't lost, it's actually retained in the event horizon.
And what does this tell us about the universe? Why is this so important?
Well, I mean, it's a conceptual breakthrough, because in terms of what is it going to affect in terms of our knowledge of physics, not a whole lot. I mean, I haven't seen the scientific paper. This is a closed-door conference. It's just been announced. It's very exciting. So we'd have to see what the overall implications are. So the key thing is that black holes can eventually evaporate and shrink. And Hawking's new idea suggests that, you know, evaporating black holes would actually transmit that information. And evaporating black holes, of course, evaporate on timescales that are longer than the age of the universe. So in terms of a real observable signature, it's unclear to me there's anything. But it's definitely a big conceptual breakthrough if this holds up.
Why is it a closed-door conference? That's a little suspicious, isn't
it? Well, it's because, you know, there are lots of theories and lots of proposals, and scientists kind of duke things out.
Priya Natarajan, professor of astronomy and physics at Yale, talking with us about the latest theory from Stephen Hawking. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we're going to spend the next few minutes on the blue zones. Maybe you've heard they're the regions of the world researchers once circled with blue pencil because the people there lived longer than anywhere else in the world. Dan Buettner wrote the National Geographic cover story on blue zones. He turned that into two best-selling books. And now maybe he has a third bestseller on the way. The new Blue Zone Solutions is about Dan's efforts to duplicate blue zones in American communities, teaming with famed food scientists and civic leaders and with money from public funds and from insurance companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield and the for-profit health company Healthways. He and his teams get thousands of people to gather in auditoriums in towns like Albert Lea, Minnesota, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to pledge to implement ideas like walking school buses. This is where seniors walk groups of kids to school and everyone gets exercise. They pledge to begin eating a bowl of beans a day. Dan says it's the best longevity supplement out there. And to create a community of like-minded people. For example, do you have a Moai? Dan Buettner joins us now. And Dan, what is a Moai?
It's a committed social network, and we first observed it in Okinawa. Okinawa is home to the longest-lived women on the planet. And we discovered that having a strong, committed social network is more important than getting on the best diet you can imagine, because a good social network will last longer and be more measurably impactful than trying to remember what you put in your mouth every day.
Well, and in Okinawa, it's women, usually five women, each have known each other their whole lives and are there for almost every moment in their lives going forward.
They at least meet once a day. They will gossip. Maybe they'll have a glass of sake. But if one of them don't show up to this nightly meeting, the other four put their kimonos on and they shuffle across the village to check in on their friends. And at a certain age, having that sort of not only literal care, which would require a nurse or something in our society, but also the psychological safety net to know that somebody has your back. Our team believed it was a major contributor to the longevity there.
Well, it corresponds with research that, you know, we've reported on here, that you will be like the community that you're in. If everyone around you is overweight or smoking, it's like a magnet. It's much harder to resist that gravitational pull.
Yes, if your three best friends are unhealthy and obese, there's 150% better chance that you will be too. Same with what you smoke. Happiness, even loneliness, is contagious. And loneliness is also deadly in this country. If you meet the technical definition of loneliness, if you don't have at least three friends you can count on a bad day, it'll shave 8 years off your life expectancy. So what Blue Zones has taught us is the importance of building up a good social network of people who care about you and then having the right environment.
So the Moai is just one of many of the strategies you brought over and implemented in the Blue Zones project. Before we get to that, just to remind people, the zones you mentioned, Okinawa, with the world's longest living women. There's an island in Greece that has one of the world's lowest rates of mid-age mortality. A region in Sardinia, the Italian island, the highest concentration of long-living men. Second to that is the Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica, the world's lowest rate of mid-age deaths. And Loma Linda, California, where some people live 10 more healthy years than the average American. Just for a second, park on Loma Linda. What was the key there?
The Seventh-day Adventist. They subscribe to a biblical diet. They take their diet right out of Genesis chapter 1. They eat basically beans and vegetables, if you're a true Adventist, and grains. And their social networks tend to be healthy. So the contagions that spread within those networks are healthy.
So there's Loma Linda, California. What did they all have in common, though, that became the basis for this project that you wanted to bring to communities in the U.S.?
On average, 90% of their caloric intake comes from plants or very simple plant products. 65% of their dietary intake come from grains and tubers and beans. They do eat meat, but on average only 5 times a month. And the go-to snack in all the Blue Zones is nuts.
And by the way, we'll have lists of the food from each of the zones at hereandnow.org. But as you said, it has more to do with a community-wide way of living. How do you start bringing that to communities?
You have to find communities that are ready. When you look at Blue Zones around the world, in none of these places do you find spry centenarians who said at age 50, well, God darn it, I'm going to get on that longevity diet, or they never bought the treadmill. They lived in environments that made the healthy choice the easy choice. So it was longevity was something that ensued instead of something you pursue, which is very different than the way we do it in America. So we package up this idea that you can create a healthier environment in American communities, and then we get the mayor and the city manager and the superintendent of schools and the CEOs of the big companies to sign a pledge saying, yes, come change the default, change the nudges here so that healthier is easier than unhealthy.
Nudge. We know the book by a Chicago economist, and that's the idea that the environment is slowly changed so it nudges people in a different direction. And you tell the story of Bob Fagan, city manager of Spencer, Iowa, who got a big personal nudge first.
Yeah, he was diagnosed with kidney failure. He was on 5 medicines, and his father had died of kidney failure, and his doctor made a deal with him. If he went on this Blue Zone program and stuck with it long enough and showed improvement, that he could go off the medicines. And after 6 months, it worked. And as city manager, he led the charge in Spencer to put in about 200 new sidewalks. So walking became easier than driving, to change the food policies to favor fruits and vegetables over chips and sodas, led the charge to help create moais so that people had good social networks. And then the Hy-Vee stores there took on a Blue Zone.
This is a grocery store there, yeah.
Yeah, grocery stores that curated a checkout aisle. So after you've been shopping for an hour and you're hungry, instead of staring down candy bars and sodas, there you stare down bags of nuts and waters. And those checkout lanes actually generated more revenue than the unhealthy checkout lanes.
We'll take one thing at a time. How do you make a moai?
Okay, so the point of a moai is not creating a walking group. It's to help people make new friends. So when we put moais together, we separate a group of, say, 500 people. We put all the new mothers in one area, all the older mothers in another area, single people in a third area. And then we have them circle up and we throw out a number of questions. Raise your hand if you like rock and roll. Raise your hand if your idea of a delicious meal is steak and potatoes or vegan. And then we have them self-select into groups of 5, and we simply assign them to walk together for 10 weeks. And we find that after about 6 weeks, there's a tipping point. They forge these long-term friendships, which we know have a long-term impact on their health.
But I'm sure there are people who say, I'm struggling to just get my kids off to school in the morning. I can't be slow cooking beans. People are pretty stressed out. How did you address that attitude?
So you make 250 food decisions a day, and only about 50 of those are conscious. The other 200 are unconscious. So what the Blue Zone Project does is engineer your unconscious decisions to be healthier. So when we show up in a city, we're going to have 3 squads of people. 1 squad of people is going to help you set up your kitchen. A 2nd squad is going to go to every restaurant, grocery store, school, and workplace. And using a checklist-driven strategy, we get them to make their eating environments 20% healthier. And then the 3rd squad works with city government, municipal policy and ordinances. And we bring in a menu of best practice food policies, and we help city council adopt them. So we think of a 5-mile life radius, and we unleash a healthy swarm of nudges and defaults. And we've seen in some cities the BMI, body mass index collectively drop as much as 15% by using this strategy instead of guilting and educating.
Well, and talk about some of the nudges. I mean, one city might bring in somebody who he sounds almost like the street whisperer who might help them reorganize their streets so they have bike lanes. What are some of the nudges?
So Dan Burden is kind of street whisperer. That's a great he's an expert in working with city planners within budget to create streets that are made for humans and not just cars. If you build a street with bike lanes, with sidewalks, and with cleaned up parks, you can raise the physical activity level of that whole community by 30%. Albert Lea, Minnesota, we saw life expectancy rise by almost 3 years. Healthcare costs for city workers went down by about 40%. In Bob Fagan's town, Spencer, healthcare costs for city workers went down by about 25%. In the beach cities of Los Angeles, we've seen the smoking rate drop by 29%. So it seems to be working. And the beauty is, because we don't rely on a silver bullet, it's silver buckshot. If we unleash 80 or 90 of these nudges citywide for the long term and only 50 of them work, we still see a result.
Just to leave us, Dan, with one image that you have.
Brian Mattson in Albert Lea, Minnesota, a guy who weighed about 300 pounds and every night would come home from his work at a convenience store and watch TV and play video games. He now belongs to a Moai. He's got five new friends that we helped him make. He's lost weight. And most importantly, if you ask him, he'll say he's happy.
Dan Buettner, the new book is Blue Zone's Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest, and we would add longest living people. Dan, thanks so much.
It was a delight.
And by the way, I said, who has time to slow cook beans? Well, Dan says, canned are fine, but eat less. The Okinawa women chant, they have a chant they say before eating. It basically says, don't eat everything, don't get full. Dan says, Americans can just buy smaller plates. We'll have the Blue Zone foods listed at hereandnow.org, where we'd also love to hear from you if you live in Iowa or the beach cities in Los Angeles and have gone through the Blue Zone project. Did you, for instance, switch your kids' fundraisers from candy to walkathons? What did you do? Let us know at hereandnow.org. And that is the sound of a Sumatran rhino. And it's a sound we won't be hearing in the U.S. much longer, because the last Sumatran rhino living in a U.S. zoo, in fact, the last Sumatran rhino living anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, is headed to Indonesia sometime in the fall. Here to tell us why and what it means is Vicky Croak, who reports on all things animal for Here and Now. And Vicky, we know this rhino was at the Cincinnati Zoo, so why are they sending it away?
Hey, Robin. Well, we're talking about Harapan, who's a beautiful 8-year-old Sumatran rhino. Sumatrans are the smallest of the five rhino species, but still, this guy is about 1,800 pounds, and he's shaggy. They're called the hairy rhino sometimes. He was born at the Cincinnati Zoo as part of their successful Sumatran breeding program, but he's all alone now. No one to mate with, and in the wild, his species is critically endangered. Their numbers are at an all-time low, staggeringly low, just 100 animals altogether. These guys are in trouble, so it makes sense to send this guy back where he can be a father.
Can an animal, a rhino raised in a zoo, live in the wild?
Well, Harapan will be going to Sumatra, but to a national park, and he won't exactly be at the mercy of a big bad forest. There's a sanctuary there set up, the Sumatran Rhino Sanctuary. Terry Roth, who's the director of the zoo's Center for Conservation and Research of Endangered Wildlife, has been there many times over the last 16 years. And here's how she describes it.
The sanctuary itself is all fenced off, but they're large enclosures, and it is right in the middle of a natural forest. The rhinos are brought in every morning for a bath, for an inspection. They get, hand fed. So they're very cared for.
Well, it sounds actually delightful for him. But will they still be safe? Are rhinos there still safe from what is killing them off? Is it poachers?
Well, one really reassuring factor we have is that Harapan's older brother, Andalus, also a zoo-born rhino, has been living there for a few years. And Roth says he's taken it all in stride. He hasn't even had one sick day since he went. And as far as poaching goes, that is a threat to the species. But the sanctuary is fenced in and patrolled around the clock by rhino protection units.
Oh, wow. Well, and this is all good news, especially since the world has become more aware of endangered animals and poaching, and with the story of Cecil Newcastle. But what about Cincinnati? They must be sad seeing go.
They are. And you know something, Robin? I met Harapan's mother, Emmy, years ago. She's unfortunately dead now, but I can tell you she was an absolute sweetheart, kind of a big, shaggy lapdog of a rhino whom I got to pat. But I asked Roth specifically about Sumatran rhinos and their charm.
Are we wrong to fall in love with Sumatran rhinos and think they're really cute?
Oh, no. They are, you know, they are extremely charismatic. Not only their appearance with their shaggy hair, but it's their personalities, too. You know, they're not afraid of us. They're not aggressive. They're actually quite friendly, quite curious. It's hard not to fall in love with them.
So what are the plans now?
Harapan's being crate trained like we do with dogs for his big trip, but we really know that things are urgent. Just last week, there was a serious scientific paper published in the journal Oryx, and it basically sent up a distress call saying that there were no more Sumatran rhinos left in the wild in nearby Malaysia, and urging that we treat the remaining 100 Sumatran rhinos anywhere, wild or captive, as one population with no borders. And that's just what's happening with this effort to move Harapan to the other side of the planet. Roth and her team at the Cincinnati Zoo have really unlocked a lot of secrets of Sumatran rhino reproduction, and it's hoped that they'll continue to be part of the effort to increase numbers for the species in the wild.
And you tell us the name Harapan means hope in Indonesian.
That's right.
Vicky Kroek, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
We're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina slamming into New Orleans. That storm sent thousands of people, tens of thousands, outside New Orleans to other cities, including Baton Rouge. And that growth in population led to a lot more traffic, as a new study from Texas A&M this week shows. Reporter Amy Jeffries has more.
Ask just about anyone in Baton Rouge about the traffic, and they'll give you a similar answer.
I think it's horrible.
It's been bad for a while now.
Trying to get on the highway, it's always heavy traffic trying to get on there.
Right now, it's horrible.
Traffic's terrible. Traffic's terrible in Baton Rouge.
Some point to Hurricane Katrina as a milestone.
It really got bad. It really got bad. After Katrina, it never caught a break since then.
Rodney Oob drives over the Mississippi River into Baton Rouge once or twice a week to take his son to the barbershop or to go shopping. But if he doesn't start making his way over by 2:30 in the afternoon, he says he might as well wait if he doesn't want to be stuck in traffic.
Been 10 years now, dealing with an hour to get across the bridge.
The number of cars and trucks crossing the Horace Wilkinson Bridge, locals just call it the New Bridge, peaked in 2005 at an average of 106,000 a day. It was close to that at last count in 2013. But don't blame it all on Katrina. The storm was followed by an oil and gas boom. Tim Lomax, a researcher with the Texas A&M Transportation Institute, says that 1-2 punch explains Baton Rouge's elevated place in the national congestion rankings.
You had this big surge, and then you continue to have the economic development come along behind it that meant that it was just really difficult to catch up.
Louisiana tried. The state has spent more than $500 million on road improvements here since 2008, including widening three sections of interstate. The city spent tens of millions more on local road projects, but delays for commuters have still gotten longer. The average commuter spent 47 hours sitting in traffic or crawling along last year. Around 8 a.m. on a summer morning, the team in Baton Rouge's Traffic Management Center is dealing with an emergency bridge closure. Chief Engineer Ingolf Partenheimer says the picture on the wall of screens looks pretty typical.
We've had a car fire this morning already, had a truck that broke down, you know, on the main route in.
To get traffic moving around the accidents and stalls, the engineers set up detours and make changes to traffic signals. Right after Hurricane Katrina, Sarah Paul Edel, then working for the state, had to fight through the traffic herself to do that.
It was crazy. You'd have to go out and just retime a signal by yourself, like by hand, and then try to get in the traffic and sit through the traffic and get to the next one, make changes and get to the next one.
Edel says it took weeks, months even, to change signal timings that way. Now she and her colleagues can do it remotely and restore the flow much quicker. But Partenheimer says traffic managers can only do so much to unclog the gridlock without more capacity on Baton Rouge's roads.
Obviously, the interstate has to be fixed, whether that's a loop, an additional bridge, it just needs to happen.
Louisiana is studying the possibilities. Meanwhile, for a recent contest, readers of Smiley Anders' column in the Baton Rouge Advocate waxed poetic. One submission combined two favorite subjects.
And Francois wrote about football and traffic. It's LSU game day, and everyone is a quiver. Not a long commute from just across the river. But I won't make kickoff on this Louisiana Classic because I've been on Louisiana One, stuck in all the traffic.
When the next poetry contest rolls around, Anders is expecting more odes to traffic in the post-Katrina era. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Jeffries in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
And we heard in that story from Tim Lomax, a research fellow with the Texas A&M Transportation Institute, which did the study on traffic. So let's back up from Baton Rouge and take a closer look at this study, which found that American drivers lose almost 7 billion hours of their time stuck on the road each year. Washington, D.C., that metro area, leads the pack with the worst traffic. And Tim Lomax is with us now to talk more. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with Washington, D.C., right at the top of the list. How bad is the traffic there?
The average auto commuter in D.C. wastes 82 hours a year and 35 gallons of fuel in the stop-and-go traffic. So that's about 2 weeks of vacation you can think of. And if you put a value on those, it's over $1,800 a year in this congestion tax, if you will.
And then you have some usual suspects near the top of the list there, San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York City. Who's doing the best right now?
Well, certainly bigger cities are going to have worse congestion. Smaller cities are going to have better congestion. But among the really large places, the over 3 million places, San Diego and Philadelphia and Phoenix are sort of down on our list, probably for different reasons. I know San Diego has a really good traffic operations program, and so they're really aggressively managing their traffic. I think Phoenix is still sort of coming out of the housing bubble and the economic recession.
Well, yeah, what is the best way to deal with this? What can a city that ranks high on your list in a bad way do to deal with traffic at this point?
I think really what we've found over the years is that it really takes all the different kinds of solutions. So where you can add capacity, either road or transit, and you're in a growing area, a lot of times that's a part of the solution, but it's not the only solution. You also need to operate the system as efficiently as you can. So timing the traffic signals correctly, getting the crashes installed vehicles out of the way, looking at how you might operate the transit system and the roadway system more in harmony, where maybe the transit gets a little bit more priority at the signals, things like that. Letting people know about the traffic congestion is really important. That cuts down on the frustration and also gives them an idea that they ought to be looking at different routes. But clearly this isn't just an agency solution kind of thing. You got to get employers and the commuters involved in the situation so that perhaps if you have a bad traffic day, you could call into the boss and say, hey, I'm going to be coming in late. I'm going to sit at home and I'm going to work and I'm going to be productive and I'm not going to stress out about the traffic on I-93. And then I'll come in at 10 o'clock in the morning. So if you have that kind of a conversation ahead of time, it's a whole lot easier to plan your work day and your family day around the traffic congestion that you might have.
Well, and would you say that in general, traffic is getting worse across this country as more people flock to major metropolitan areas?
Certainly, that's what our data show, particularly post-economic recession. You know, the economic recession was great for congestion. It's one of the best ways to get rid of congestion is to, you know, have 10% unemployment.
Right.
I don't think anybody really thinks that's a very good solution. And clearly, as the economy has come back, particularly in places like the big Texas cities that have seen an oil boom, Baton Rouge, the high-tech cities, you know, where you see that economic progress coming back rapidly, you also see congestion returning.
And yet you don't see a whole lot of effort around this country to really update public transit systems and add many, many miles of more track. There's certainly places that are working on it, but not really commensurate with the amount of people who are coming into these cities.
I think that's what our congestion data show, that the solutions, whatever the solution set you choose, isn't being deployed in great enough numbers or fast enough to handle the jobs and population that are coming. It's a whole lot easier to build an office building or a subdivision than it is to build the transportation network to satisfy that. I think that's really one of the things that maybe our report could can help with is to start that discussion about kind of a value for money proposition. You know, nobody likes to pay more taxes, but it's clear if you look around the country that if folks are presented with a good saleable package of transportation improvements, that they'll actually vote to tax themselves because congestion is such a frustrating issue for people.
Do you think when we're all in self-driving cars, traffic will matter? Because we'll be able to get stuff done.
Well, I think clearly that's one of the things that's great about public transportation. You may have an hour train ride to work, but if you're sitting there on your laptop getting work done, that's really an hour of productive time that you don't have if you're just if you're having to drive your car. I think self-driving cars are going to be a part of the solution, certainly out in the future, not just for congestion, but also they can be a whole lot safer. You know, they can keep you from bumping into other cars and fixed objects.
That's Tim Lomax, a research fellow with the Texas A&M Transportation Institute. We'll link you to the study at hereandnow.org about where the worst traffic is in the United States. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're following that horrendous story outside Roanoke, Virginia. A reporter and cameraman reporting a light story from a shopping center, interviewing the director of a local chamber of commerce, when they were both shot and killed live on the air. We have chosen not to air the sound of that moment. The suspect is a disgruntled former reporter named Vester Flanagan. WDBJ General Manager Jeffrey Marks has been on air all morning after the shooting, which was very early this morning. He said Flanagan went by the name of Bryce Williams on air.
So we had an unhappy former employee, but this happens. And usually they move on.
Right.
Sometimes they're just not suited for the work, and they move on, get a job somewhere else. But he had remained in town.
Schools were shut down for a time as police chased the suspect. WDBJ is now reporting that he shot himself while driving, then crashed his car and is in critical condition. Again, reporter Allison Parker, her cameraman Adam Ward, in their 20s, both dead. Sandy Houseman is a reporter with WVTF and Virginia Public Radio. And Sandy, it sounds like their colleagues and probably people who were watching this morning at 6:45 are reeling.
Absolutely. The station, of course, was in many ways like a family. People who work there said as much. The suspect is 41 years old. He apparently shot himself following a chase along Interstate 66, but we don't have any more information on his condition, but he's said to be alive. Earlier, the suspect, Mr. Flanagan, had tweeted that one of his victims, 27-year-old cameraman Adam Ward, had complained to Human Resources after working with him once. And the suspect claimed in a tweet that his second victim, 24-year-old Allison Parker, made racist remarks. An Equal Employment Opportunities Commission complaint was filed against her, but an investigation found no basis for it, and that complaint was dismissed. Flanagan, who, as you say, was known as Bryce Williams on the air, is black. Both victims were white. ABC News says it received a 23-page manifesto from someone named Bryce Williams, and that document has now been turned over to investigators.
So there is background to this, assuredly, and there are shootings as horrendous as they are, but this one broadcast live. You know, how are people in the area responding to that? I know you're just like reporting on it now as it's happening, but people saw this.
Yeah, it was a terrible thing to watch. Allison Parker was interviewing a local official about economic development in Smith Mountain Lake, a resort community about an hour from Roanoke. Viewers saw the two on camera talking, and then you hear the shots being fired and screams. And the camera apparently fell to the ground and caught a glimpse of Flanagan pointing a handgun at the lens. It's really chilling. Later, Flanagan tweeted that he had actually recorded the shooting and posted the video to Facebook.
And that's all been scrubbed from social media, all his tweets on the Facebook. From watching on air, watching the various people from WDBJ come on air, they've been covering this all morning. They all look so young. And apparently, Allison Parker and Adam Ward, again in their 20s, were in relationships. Here's again WDBJ General Manager Jeffrey Marks talking about that.
They both were in love, and we'll talk about that a little more with other members of the team here. And our hearts are broken, and our sympathies go to the entire staff here, but also the parents and family of Adam Ward and Allison Parker, who were just out doing their job today.
Yeah. Sandy Hausman, people are going to be weighing in on this, I know, looking at it from different ways of looking at something through the cultural prism. You've got social media, you've got live television, you've got, you know, all of this combining. But just staying with the journalistic aspect of this, you know, television journalists know they're visible. They're often in the middle of chaos with Klieg lights on them. Reporters are always umbilically tied to their cameramen. These are very close relationships. They're literally connected by their equipment. What are the reporters in town saying about, you know, being targets?
I have not heard much from other reporters. I think in a strange way we feel that we are not vulnerable, that there's something about being a journalist, being an observer, that sets you apart from real-life events. And so this makes the shooting today doubly shocking.
Yeah. Any sense of what is going to be happening now? The suspect said to be in critical condition?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just have to wait and see whether he recovers from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And of course, in the meantime, memorials are pouring into the station. You made mention of relationships. Allison Parker was actually engaged to one of the news anchors from the station. Mm-hmm. The two had just moved in together. They recently celebrated her birthday. And her fiancé released this heartbreaking statement, mm-hmm. saying that they were very much in love. They were together about 9 months. He said it was the best 9 months of their lives. She was the most radiant woman he had ever met. And for some reason, he said, she loved me back. The cameraman who was killed was also engaged to a member of the news team, the producer of that morning show. So, again, truly heartbreaking. And the cameraman, Mr. Ward, was a graduate of Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech, of course, put a statement out decrying more senseless gun violence. One of Ward's professors, Robert Denton, described him as a delightful person. He worked hard. You could tell he loved what he was doing. He wasn't afraid to pitch in and do whatever was necessary for the broadcast. He did whatever was needed with a smile and with grace.
Sandy Hausman of Virginia Public Radio, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.